I'm going to come to Deirdre in a moment just on Trevor England's point about opposition, but I just want to give you the chance to bounce back because there was a specific criticism from Alex Atwood. He thought you shouldn't have not reappointed the same Parades Commission members, that you should have just, if I get you right, rolled on the current existing Parades Commission at a time when its future is up for discussion.
Well, it was obviously crucially important that we maintain, you know, decision-making capacity under the current system, unless and until Richard Hass's group comes up with an appropriate and a workable alternative. It's vital that the Parades Commission is maintained. But the current term of the current commissioners was coming to an end. We're now in a routine appointments process to fill those vacancies and appoint a new commission. Reappointment is not a default option for this government. I think
you extended the assembly by a year. There's 108 people that just got extra.
I think it's a slightly different issue. But, I'm very supportive of the work this current commission's done, but there's also a case when one is looking at whether to reappoint or to fill a vacancy with a new candidate. There is merit in having fresh thinking apply to what is a very, very difficult job.
Deirdre Heaton and Trevor Ringland said that if you're going to have a cross-community power-sharing government, you obviously have to have a cross-community opposition. But how can you guarantee that? It's up to a party to decide whether it wants to be an opposition or government, isn't it?
Well, I think you can't address it, and that's exactly the issue. I do think, in terms of opposition, I said earlier, I think we need an opposition because we need to address the apathy, and we also need to say that our government system is going to mature and develop, and the only way I can see that happening is the development of an opposition. I think the smaller parties in Northern Ireland are schizophrenic. One day they're in government, the next day they're in opposition, and they're not quite sure where they are. Can they prove themselves to be a government in waiting? Can they perform the role of a shadow government? Can they act in a backbench manner? I'm not so sure. Will they be able to set aside party politics and say, we're going to work together as an opposition? And those are the questions I think people want addressed. Would that actually ever work? Or would you be 5 minutes into a conversation before party politics would again trump any other consideration in terms of opposition?
I want to get a few people in. Jim, I'm coming to you afterwards, Jim, but gentleman behind you. I was going to say gentleman in the check shirt, but you've both got check shirts on, so I can't.
Okay, all right. With the referendum in Scotland, is this not an opportunity for us to look at the reform of democracy in the United Kingdom? I'm married to an English woman. I work in England quite a bit, and I recognise that within England, that they see Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland having more democracy, where it is local decisions to be made. Northern Ireland is only a very small region, that's only the size of Yorkshire. And why should the English people lose out in having the same level of local government accountability? Is this not an opportunity for us to see even a reform of the House of Commons and the House of Lords and more power devolved down to reflect the cultural and economic variation within the whole of the United Kingdom?
Okay, thanks for that point. Jim Wilson wanted another quick point. It better be because it's your second point. I've got two guys over there.
I have lots of questions. Okay. Point. No, I find it rich from the Alliance Party to tell us that about the walls coming down in 10 years' time, considering what thought went into the decision by the Alliance Party and the SDLP and the taking away of the flag and the damage that it's done to people like myself who've worked at Interfaces for 30 years. And it's probably knocked us back 15 years, what that decision, and although it was a legitimate decision, but where was the thinking in those political parties who decided to do that? And in hindsight of what has happened, you know, would they have advised their party councillors in Belfast to make the same decision? Because I think it's very important that we need to learn from our past, and even the past, which is only a year ago. And I think it's important that people who sit and say about taking barriers down need to know what it's like to work at Interfaces for X amount of years and then to have that all trailed away from them by decisions that they made without no thought or forethought of what would happen in this community, in this country.
Okay, good point. I'll put that to Stephen Farrell in a moment, but there's two people who've been waiting over here. First of all, gentleman with the sort of red collar and then gentleman with blue shirt after that.
Thank you very much. Picking up on Theresa's fresh thinking, For the price of the paper clips and the stationery of you guys, I'm sure the Civic Forum could be paid well and would be able to provide the fresh thinking and a democratic voice with a lot of people with energy and expertise, and it would be much less divisive, I'm thinking, than the horror picture of a House and Commons type of Yahoo going along with our quite poisonous politics here.
Who needs a civic forum? We could keep East Belfast Speaks Out going night after night, couldn't we? A gentleman in the blue shirt.
Just a question in relation to the third limb of the past, where obviously that's a fairly vexed question, but one person was brave enough to put forward a proposal the week before last, and that, dare I mention his name, the Attorney General.
You can name him. He's called John Larkin.
I'm afraid Alex might choke if I mention his name. So there seems to be an issue with the SDLP and the Attorney General, so maybe you'd like to talk about that. But there was a very interesting piece today in the newsletter. I don't know if anybody saw it, but it was an interview Sam McBride had with John McBurney, the solicitor with the family of the Harry Breen, the police officer murdered, and the Semitic Tribunal. And his proposal was very interesting, and I'd just be interested in some thoughts from the panel, where he was discussing that perhaps we shouldn't be considering an amnesty, but rather immunity, if there's engagement in an actual process. And it's worthwhile for everyone that's jumped to automatic reactions and, frankly, hysterical reactions last week, if people could actually read that article, see exactly what it says, and then if they don't agree with it, perhaps at least have an open mind and listen to the arguments.
Okay, a few different points there. First of all, Stephen Farry, with hindsight, would Alliance councillors with the party do it again?
Well, first of all, the timing of the decision last year wasn't something of our making. We had to respond to a particular situation that was presented before us. But the decision that we took was right in December of 2012, and the party would take the same decision today. And indeed, I think we need to have a standard approach around the flying of flags in civic buildings across Northern Ireland, rather than having a situation where, looking to the future, we have potentially 11 new councils all facing the same dilemma. And let's look at this, in first of all, on the actual merits of the case around the flag. What happened in Belfast City Council is little different than what happens in other parts of Northern Ireland, indeed other parts where unionist parties are in control. It's little different from what happens in most other councils in the UK itself. So Belfast is a little different. The flag in Belfast itself was only been flown all year round from the mid-1980s, from the Anglo-Irish Agreement. It hasn't been flown historically through the whole history of the Northern Ireland state. We also have to recognise that Belfast is a shared city and have an approach that addresses all of that. So the decision itself was the right one to take. Also bear in mind that we have, for the first time, nationalist parties buying into the flying of the flag and celebrating the Queen's birthday and other members of the royal family. That's all progress and could have been bought us and understood as such. However, what we have had is a situation where it was whipped up in the first place, where leaflets were put out, stirring the situation, building up tensions around the vote. And then afterwards, a situation where people, for whatever political reason, decided to further whip up tensions and to have what emerged on the streets, which caused a lot of damage to community relations. It caused damage to our economy, in particular for traders. And it's beyond me as to why, even this year, we're now yet again facing that situation where people are talking about parades in the Belfast this Saturday. On the issue of the past, Mark, and maybe just to...
Actually, I'll come back to the past and I'll come back to John Larkin, but okay. Particularly as it is the issue coming up on this Saturday, I wanted just to go for a quick response from everybody. Obviously, you don't think that this Saturday's parade is a good idea. You more or less said that already.
Well, obviously, people have a right. I accept people's right to freedom of assembly, but sometimes it's more responsible to walk away than exercise that right. And given the pressures on traders, I think everyone has to have a degree of common sense. And indeed, some of those who may wish to demonstrate against the decision have a stake in the future of our economy and may well be in jobs, or they may be looking for jobs in the future. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to further undermine the progress that we've been trying to make in the past number of years.
Mike Nesbitt, what's your take on this Saturday's parade?
Well, I have consistently, since about the first week of December last said to people that I believe they should forsake their right to go out on the streets. They have that right under Article 11, as I said, but it is a tactic. It is a means to an end, and if the end is to get the flag restored at Belfast City Hall, that tactic will not work. It did not work 30 years ago when people went out in their tens and hundreds of thousands against the Anglo-Irish Agreement. It did not go away. Street protest will not get the flag back up. We need to be strategic. We need to use brains and not brawn, and there's a whole basket of measures we could take, but it does not include going out on the streets.
Secretary of State, you were answering questions about this in the House of Commons earlier on today.
Yes, I think it's, you know, I understand the strength of feeling about the flag. I'm fully supportive of efforts to fly the Union flag, but the reality is that this protest could do significant damage to the city centre. I mean, it's, as I've said, we are recovering from a significant recession. You know, the last thing the retailers need in our city centre is on one of the busiest shopping days of the entire year to have people reluctant to come out and do their shopping. So whilst I respect the cause, I think it's it is regrettable that this protest is going ahead on this day at this location.
And just finally on that point, Alex Atwood, and then we'll come to some of the other topics.
I think that the parade shouldn't go ahead. But what I would say to people is that if it is going ahead, then those organisations and parties who at this stage on Wednesday night are inclined to go, that each of them should consider the PUP, the UVF, if they think they're going to turn up, loyalist organisations, marching orders. I think that it falls to each of those organisations to ask each of themselves the question, should they go on Saturday? And I think what you'll find is that if one says, we think, for all the arguments that have been outlined on this in this meeting, if one says, we actually think on reflection it's not the right thing to do, then I think you'll find other organisations showing the same leadership. And in that way, potentially take the heat out of what could arise on Saturday.
Did you want to come back just on Saturday's parade? I'll let you have a quick comeback because I'm aware that everybody seems to think it's a bad idea up here. So just
First and foremost, no matter what Martin McGuinness said in the Assembly, and no one challenged him, the UVF are not behind this parade on Saturday. This is people that are fed up their back teeth. It was the flag that broke a camel's back over a lot of issues. But a question on the flags I'd like to put to Theresa. There was a hate crime thing brought in here to deal with Muslims. Maybe people that were going to blow up, extremist Muslims that were going to blow up parts of England and all right. But Jimmy Bryson, Willie Fraser, they were charged with that. They were interned for a month without trial for innocent flag protesting. Those hate charges were put to them as if they were some sort of mad mullahs. They're now out. They're now free of all charges. They're completely innocent. Now, I would like to know what part you played in that, and those people getting charged and interned for 4 weeks each without trial, and at the end of the day they were innocent. It was just to get them off the street and stop them peacefully protesting.
Well, decisions on charges and arrests are for the police. Decisions on custody and remand in advance of trial are for the courts. So, no, I wasn't involved in those cases. But I think it's certainly absolutely right that anyone who is involved in law-breaking in relation to protests does feel the full force of the law. I'm not going to comment on those individual cases, but it is entirely counterproductive to the cause of Britishness, to the cause of supporting the Union flag, to go out and break the law. And it's entirely damaging to Northern Ireland to see our streets disfigured by violence. And it can be disastrous for the individuals concerned, not least of which could well end up with many having a criminal record, which will be with them for life. If people genuinely are patriotic, if they genuinely care about Britishness, if they genuinely care about the flag, throwing bricks at police officers is not the way to demonstrate it.
Okay, well, do you want to come back on this particular point? Because before we move on to any other topics, I've got about two more still stacked up. Okay.
Just like to quickly say, Secretary of State said that anyone broke the law, protesters, etc., should feel the full force of the law. Gerry Kelly broke the law by obstructing police officers. Do you think he should have the full force of the law brought upon him? And why hasn't it been?
Whether the law has been broken in that case is a matter for the police to investigate.
Okay. Obviously, there was a point there raised about John Larkin and Amnesty. And I think that the point was that there might be a possibility of, if you like, some more limited immunity. I don't know that I necessarily understand the difference between those two, but do you think that there's any room for manoeuvre in that, Deirdre Heenan?
Well, I think it was a very interesting debate. I think he had the right to voice his opinion, and I agree with the man from the floor who said he has been demonised and there's been hysteria over and a complete overreaction to what he said. The reality is, and it's a reality that people may not want to hear, but if evidence is inaccessible, then in many cases justice is unavailable, and it's cruel and misleading to suggest otherwise. The Antrim Road in the 1980s was not CSI Miami, and the evidence may well not be there to prosecute people, and I think we have to have a reality check here, and to promise people that they're all going to get justice, that all victims are going to have closure, is not realistic. I'm not saying that we don't listen to the voice of victims. Of course we listen to the voice of victims, but who leads policy here? And when is someone going to decide that we have to deal with the past? We spend so much time talking about the past, yet we can't seem to come up with a viable way of dealing with the past and allow us to move forward and draw out a future that most people want.
Mike Nesbitt, John Larkin, do you think there's any room for manoeuvre on any more limited immunity? It was offered, obviously, in relation to decommissioning of weapons. It was offered in relation to the disappeared information about them.
There are precedents in terms of the last 40 years in this country. I felt, and I did read it, I felt John Larkin had done an Eames Bradley. A lot of what he published, I would actually agree with. There was a whole basket of measures. And yet, within that basket, there was one obvious front-page headline, which was as explosive as the recognition payment in the consultative group on the past. You know, he says there's very, very little prospect of most victims and survivors getting truth and justice. They know that. Victims and survivors know that. They have known it for decades. But there's still something about taking away that right. And I don't feel I have the moral authority, particularly without consulting, to sit down with a victim and a survivor and say, I am now denying you your right, slim as the prospects are, to having your day in court, particularly without consulting. But beyond that, I mean, he's talking about the processes and the fact that they are imbalanced or imperfect, and actually they put an undue focus on the state and the agents of the state, mm-hmm. because what we do is we have public inquiries, by definition, only looking at the state. We have the police ombudsman, by definition, only looking at alleged wrongdoing by policemen. We have Article 2 compliant coroner's courts, and they're all about killings that are contested and carried out by members of the security forces. And finally, we have the HET, which reviews the files on all Troubles-related killings, but the HET, in public perception, is a busted flush. So, yes, I think we do need to discuss a new mechanism. Yes, I agree with him when he says there is a role for historians. I think there is. I think we do need to establish a factual timeline because it has become so twisted in people's imagination. We need somebody, and I wouldn't trust lawyers or politicians to do this, to say, here are the facts, right through from the 1960s to the present day. So there is a lot in what John Larkin said, but just like the recognition payment, I think to just blast out, without consulting, particularly the Victims Forum, on this draw line, was probably thought through, but it was impossible for me to support it, because I don't have that moral authority.
Alex Howard, you weren't exactly a member of the John Larkin fan club even before he made this intervention. What did you make of it, and do you think there is room for anything in terms of more limited immunity?
Well, the first thing is, I don't know who Deirdre and others refer to as hysterical, but the people who spoke with greatest clarity and conviction last week were the victims and survivors, and they certainly weren't hysterical. What they demonstrated, as they always demonstrate, is resilience and dignity, their pain and their wisdom. And they were not hysterical. They were saying to everybody who was listening that after all that they had endured, they may have to endure more, yes, but there were some things that they weren't going to accept. What was the problem with the Attorney General's proposal? It wasn't that some line of law would shift again. it was that there would be no law. Because when you say there's going to be no inquests, no investigations, no prosecutions, and no inquiries, and they were his four proposals, he was saying that when it came to the issue of the past, there would be no legal established mechanisms to look at that. And you cannot say to any victim or survivor that you take away from them the established legal mechanisms, limited though they might be, and that they are, and the victims and survivors know this, limited though they are, to get to the truth. Let's put all that aside. This is the moment that I think we are now living in over the next 5 weeks, that the victims and survivors have made the outside world, the biggest strength in Haas and O'Sullivan is the voices from outside the talks room. It is not the parties within the talks room. And that those voices have bombarded Haas and O'Sullivan over the last 2 months. There have now been over twice the number of submissions to this talks process than there were to Eames Bradley. And the strongest and the most articulate of those voices is the victims and survivors. So despite the darkness that's all around us, the bomb in Belfast and the potential of this weekend and the last year, this is the moment that we are now in. The best moment in 15 years to deal comprehensively and ethically with the past and give to victims and survivors all that they seek. It may not bring healing or reconciliation or truth or justice, but you must give to the victims and survivors all that they seek.
Okay.
And at the measure, and I'll finish now, Mark, the measure of the next 5 weeks is for everybody, Haas, O'Sullivan and the governments and the parties, to stand with the victims and survivors as they make that demand, and that people stand with them too.
Okay,
can I just come back to that as a non-politician and say, to make a statement to say you must give victims all that they seek, when we know the reality. We know the reality of the success rate of HET. We know the reality of coroner's courts. It's a ludicrous statement, if you don't mind me saying. The bottom line is we have to face the context in which we are sitting. And for many people, the evidence simply is inaccessible. Memories fade, records aren't there, and we have a focus on the state which is damaging for us moving forward, and we have to address it. And it's a drip, drip, drip corrosive effect which has to be addressed.
So very, very briefly, then we come back to that. So what Deirdre is now saying to victims and survivors, that it is ludicrous for them to seek the four things that they wish to have.
I did not
and
say that.
This is what they, what victims and survivors want. They want the truth, but they know that there's going to be very limited opportunities for that, but they nonetheless want a process of truth. And then they want accountability. And then they want acknowledgement. And it is in around all of those themes and strands
that you can give to victims and survivors. With respect, Alex, that is not true. Victims and survivors are very different. Some want truth and justice. Yeah. Some just want truth. That's some right. want neither. Yeah. They are not all the same. A lot of them just want help with physical pain. Right. Even more have very poor mental health and well-being.
Some want revenge.
And some want revenge, yes.
You forgot about that, and that's Daniel's whole thing.
OK. I'm going to come to Stephen Farron, because I think I cut you off as you were just about to get to this. But just to make the point, yeah. I think the Director of Public Prosecutions actually addressed a conference in the summer. Now, he didn't go as far as the Attorney General, but the point that he did make is that there's a decision for society to take, yeah. that if it does want to proceed with full justice in this regard, he needs a lot more resources than society has put at his disposal.
Yeah. I think, Mark, the problem is that we have begun to frame this debate in terms of an either-or, in terms that there's a fork in the road here. We have to decide which road we're going to take. I see this as being a both-and situation. I think there are dangers in taking the classic justice routes off the table, and that's where the reaction was occurring last week, because the victims themselves felt that was being taken away from them without their voices being heard in that regard. It was a top-down process where the state was essentially saying you can't have your justice, even though that justice may be unrealistic. People want to cling on to that hope in the sense that they may be one of the few in practical reality, like we can accept that, who do receive that justice. But alongside that, we can potentially build an alternative route through which we find the truth. And there may well be a situation where some sort of qualified immunity does play a role in that regard. But the issue has to be that the victims themselves make the decision as to which route their cases are going to be handled through. It's not for others to make those decisions on behalf of the victims. I think inadvertently John Larkin may have actually sparked this debate to a sense where we could actually make some progress, not in the direction perhaps he envisaged himself, but because of the scale of the reaction that we have seen, the intensity of some people's viewpoints, and I think even from the point of view of Richard Haass, the clarity now in terms of how maybe some of the choices available to us will now be seen.
Sorry, there's a gentleman there. Let's get in on this.
I would like to change the topic, actually, if that's okay.
Okay, well, I'll call you in a moment then, because I've got two other topics already sitting here. Was anybody who wanted to come back particularly on this or not? No? No? Oh, yeah. Well, no. Yeah. Trevor, sorry, you've had your go. Actually, sorry, you put the question in the first point, so briefly come back, yeah.
Yeah. Sorry if I confused you, Mark, with the question, but basically the Smithwick Tribunal is that you furnish information, and in exchange, you obtain immunity. So you provide information to those individuals that Alex describes in uniformity, but as Mike describes, there isn't uniformity, and you don't.
So there's an incentive involved, you're saying, rather than it just being an amnesty that's just given out.
There's an exchange, exactly. And the whole focus of this, the last 10, 15 years, has all been about what the state has done. And actually, that's not what a lot of victims want to know the answers to. They want to know what former politicians, current politicians, what they did, what Gerry Adams did. What organisation was Gerry Adams in? Martin McGuinness was furnished the opportunity to admit what organisation he was a member of as part of the Bloody Sunder Tribunal, because there was a mechanism to enable him to do that.
That's fine.
We need to give people a mechanism.
Yeah. Sorry, is it a gentleman in the front here? I don't know if this is the same topic or if it's a different topic you wanted to go for. Yeah.